There's always more work that has to be done, especially when you're a creative person who's not bounded by 9-to-5. No one drops assignments on your desk. You have to self-generate everything. And even if you're good at it, there's always another book to be researched, another story to be written, another song strummed, and the chords found for. And the problem is that whichever one you pick, it's the wrong one. Because if you move ahead on the book, you get behind on the article. And if you move ahead on the article, you get behind on the book. And if you write the short story, for which there might not be a market, then you get behind on the song, which you might be able to play for somebody. And so there's this constant cognitive dissonance in which everything you do is wrong, and even if you do it well, it's still the incorrect choice. That is one sure way in which your innings become infinite. One way in which I know not to spend my time is on Hall of Fame debates, and yet it's sometimes incumbent upon me to do so because of my position as a baseball commentator. I say that as if someone conferred it on me. Sometimes it has been conferred on me, sometimes it's self-appointed. In any case, I don't really enjoy it because in recent years, maybe always, those discussions have been reduced to a numerical basis. And by that, I mean no disrespect to Bill James and his Hall of Fame monitor or Jay Jaffe and his jaws. Bill James, I wouldn't be here without him. And Jay has been a close personal friend, and I was part of his life as he devised that system, and I took great pleasure in seeing him prosper thereby. But the problem is that they attempt to take what should be story problems and turn them into straight math problems, and therefore are ultimately reductive. In each case, they try to tell you when a player has achieved certain plateaus, at which point other players have been inducted into the Hall of Fame. They create kind of a composite Hall of Famer against which you should measure a player. But of course, a player's story, a player's fame or value or whatever you want to put on it, is not just about the statistics that he produced, but the history that he was a part of. And I was very pleased when, in the most recent edition of James's annual handbook, which came out just a week or two ago, that he said that it is not attempting to make value judgments. It is not attempting to tell you who should be in the Hall of Fame, but simply who has made such career progress that they are likely to be considered. We allow the numbers to do the thinking for us, and we don't grapple with the actual story. And as a result, we get results that are tone deaf. And by this, I'm talking about the modern baseball era committee ballot. This is the replacement for the old Veterans Committee process, the results of which are going to be announced on December 10th. The ballot was recently released, and it includes Steve Garvey, Tommy John, Don Mattingly, Jack Morris, Dale Murphy, Dave Parker, Ted Simmons, Luis Tiant, and Alan Trammell. And I don't want to debate the worthiness of those players specifically. I want to talk about what's tone deaf about it. And that is the inclusion of the two Detroit Tigers from the 1980s, Morris and Trammell, pitcher and shortstop respectively, and the exclusion of second baseman Lou Whitaker. I don't know who screened and created the ballot for the committee. It's shocking to me that a person who is aware of the history of the Detroit Tigers could look at a team and conclude that the team's best African-American player should not be included in favor of a white player who is demonstrably worse, and one whose case was only recently adjudicated through his 15 years on the ballot. What makes that a real crime is that it's doubling down on the history of the Detroit Tigers, which was very, very poor in the areas of integration and equality. Although the Tigers get a pass on integration because our attention has come to fully focus on the Boston Red Sox and the way that Tom Yawkey put off integration to 1959, the Tigers were right behind him. The Tigers were owned either in part or in whole from 1919 through 1952 by a Detroit industrialist named Walter Briggs. And then his son was forced to sell after Briggs's death, but managed to ensconce himself as the general manager for a few years thereafter. And so essentially from 1919 through 1958, the team was in the hands of pure, unadulterated racists who refused to break the color line as it applied to that team. This was very consistent with Detroit's history of race relations, which was poor. It's not doing that story justice to boil it down to half a sentence. But suffice it to say, for now, the automotive industry encouraged African Americans to relocate to the city to work there, particularly during the Second World War, and that residents already in the city did not take kindly to the adjusted racial balance, and violence often ensued. The first person of color to play for the Detroit Tigers was actually from the Dominican Republic. Ozzie Virgil, the utility infielder and father of Ozzie Virgil, the catcher who's more recent for us, didn't show up until June 6, 1958. That is more than 11 years after Jackie Robinson's debut. He didn't start. He was there until August 1961, and he was traded to the A's. You can't say at all that he had any kind of impact. Larry Doby, the first African-American player in the American League, was traded there just before the start of the 1959 season, but he was 35 and he was finished, and he only got into 18 games and then was sold to the White Sox. The first regulars who were African-American in Detroit Tigers history did not come along until 1961. They came along at about the same time. One was Jake Wood, who was a second baseman and was a fairly terrible player, and the other was a very good player named Bill Bruton, a center fielder. He was also on the old side, though, and it wasn't until Willie Horton came up in 1963 and 1964, he first got cups of coffee then and became a regular in 1965, that the team had anything like an African-American star. He hit .273 with 325 home runs in the majors. That doesn't sound like a lot now when players are hitting 325 home runs a season, but given the offensive environment of the 60s and 70s, it's actually really good. The effects of segregation on the Tigers are still visible when you look at their overall historical record. The only African-American players to have had even 20 wins above replacement with the team are Lou Whitaker, who's number one, Chet Lemon, Horton, Tony Phillips, Curtis Granderson, and Austin Jackson. That's it. There's no African-American Hall of Famer on the Tigers, no Hank Aaron, no Willie Mays. They didn't want that guy. And to the extent that they had somebody who maybe was not of an Aaron or Mays caliber, but was certainly great by the standards of second baseman, was missed at the time, was missed by the Baseball Writers Association when Whitaker was on the ballot, and has now been missed by whoever screened this modern era committee thing because they have a fetish for Jack Morris. They are going to ram Jack Morris down the throats of the public and put him in the Hall of Fame because they have some point to make, a political point, about his 254 career wins. But what they really are doing, at least to me, is repeating the sins of the Tigers by marginalizing a player who was representative of a group of players who had already been marginalized for decades by Detroit Tigers ownership and baseball in general. In 1956, Red Smith, the Hall of Fame sports writer, that's shorthand for being a Spank Award winner, he was inducted in 1976, justifiably revered as being a great writer. He even has a volume in the Library of America, for gosh sakes. The columnist for the New York Herald Tribune and the New York Times wrote an obituary for Walter Briggs, and I was shocked to read it because he makes no reference at all to the fact that the Tigers were an apartheid baseball team. He wrote, "Walter O. Briggs was, in the narrowest and best and most exacting sense of the term, a big leaguer. Among owners of baseball clubs, real big leaguers form a small and dwindling company, a company that has shrunk further with the death of the owner of the Detroit Tigers. Baseball cannot afford to lose his kind. Mr. Briggs was a sportsman, one of the very few in a game that has become, over the years, more and more a business and less a sport. He was not in baseball to make money, which he didn't need. He wasn't in it for personal publicity, which he didn't want. The passion for doing things in big league style embraced the smallest details. When exaggerating attendance figures was an almost universal practice in both leagues, Mr. Briggs ordered that the exact count be given to the press in Briggs Stadium, to the man. Anybody faking the figures would be discharged. Now and then, an honest error would be discovered after the day's attendance had been announced, and then it was a rare entertainment to watch the frantic scurrying to correct the mistake." Well, Briggs might have been a sportsman in it for the winning, but they said the same thing about Tom Yawkey, to the word. And here's the thing about that. Yawkey won nothing. Briggs, in his first 10 years of solo ownership, actually did a lot better than that. He got 3 pennants and 2 world championships. But after 1945, he won nothing. And I think you know the reason why. And it's the same reason that we're talking about this. But no one cared. Red Smith's obituary is an example of no one caring. He was celebrated as the exemplar of baseball ownership. Do you think that Red Smith would have written the same thing about Bill Veeck? No, Bill Veeck was a showman, a sideshow carnival barker. Briggs, he was a sportsman. You can say that Red Smith wasn't a racist. I'm sure he wasn't. You can say that it was the culture of the times that made him ignore this fact, though 9 years had passed since Jackie Robinson. You can say whatever the hell you want, but I know one thing. You can come up with a huge list of reasons for their not caring then, but we should sure as hell care now. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. This is it. This is the moment you've been training for all these months. The big drop. You and your fellow members of the Screaming Eagles, the 101st Airborne, will go behind enemy lines on D-Day and wreak havoc capturing key strong points. Plane has crossed the channel, the commander says hook up, and has won you rise and clip your parachute line to the wire. The green light goes on, and one by one, you and your fellow soldiers plunge out of the plane. Parachutes are opening all around you, but you don't feel the telltale tug on your back. You feel something slithering. Looking up, you see not a silk canopy, but something green and feral, mottled yellow scales and patches of fur. It perches on your shoulder. "This is how I have fun," it says. "I ride the humans all the way down." And you think, belatedly, that you should not have volunteered for the paratroopers. You should have stayed home and listened to episode 29. Next time, you'll try the Merchant Marine. Welcome back to the show. This week, I'm joined by David Roth in his usual spot in our erratic rotation. Our rotation is somewhat like that of Casey Stengel's rotation in the 1950s, where if you look at the stats on Baseball Reference, you'd have a hard time guessing who the rotation was exactly outside of Whitey Ford, and maybe not even then, because he played the hot hand a lot, and he dropped guys in and out of the rotation at will, and even Ford didn't necessarily pitch every 3 or 4 days because Casey held him out for games against top opponents, which makes Ford's record all the more amazing. But in any case, I kind of like to mix things up and keep David and Cliff Corcoran and Jesse Spector, our co-hosts, fresh, so I give them plenty of time between appearances, and they go on with their own high-achieving lives in the meantime without reference to me, and that's totally how it should be. It would be neat to have them on all the time, or all at once. I don't know how we'd get a word in edgewise. Maybe one of these days I'll try that, though, just for the fun of it, to have the great Infinite Inning crossover. But in any case, David's back this week, and we talked about the World Series and his new work at Deadspin, which involved a lot of stuff about Papa John's pizza for some reason. Both those topics took us to the usual esoteric destinations. And, of course, because it's David, I always make a point of touching on the Mets. And in this instance, maybe because they've finally moved on from Terry Collins, there was less wailing of teeth and gnashing of garments. I didn't get that even backwards. I could get that close to right. Rending of garments, wailing, keening, grinding of teeth, whatever you want to call it. But we'll just leave it. David is back, and that's all that matters. The big story this week in the online baseball writing community can be found in its best account at Deadspin under the headline, "Teen Girl Posed for 8 Years as Married Man to Write About Baseball and Harass Women." The story is written by Lindsay Adler, an acquaintance of mine. I think it's a very good story. I don't know that it explains everything about what happened to my satisfaction. I'm particularly interested because this writer was employed by Baseball Prospectus, and its reputation is near and dear to my heart. And this is not totally disinterested, the cause of writers being paid for writing is dear to my heart. And the fact that those sites tend to embrace people who don't, as Lindsay's story points out, helped enable this deception to go on for a long time. And I don't want to get into a great deal of detail about this specifically, because I feel like there's so much more to be said about it, and there's so much I don't know. And also, knowing some of the people involved in at least a tertiary way, I don't want to drag out their pain even for a moment. But I do want to comment on this one aspect, sort of in a public service kind of way. One part of the story is that this writer, this woman who was posing as a man, used threats of self-harm to intimidate women that she had met online into doing things that they wouldn't have otherwise done, including sending her photographs and things like that. Him or her, I'm not sure what the right pronoun is to use. And it shouldn't have surprised me that these women would go along in the way that they did and send the pictures. And I'm not criticizing them because their impulse was kind. Their impulse was to protect another person who was threatening to hurt themselves. That said, we need to understand, all of us, that we don't owe that to anybody. That no one who legitimately cared about us would try to leverage us in a way that was demeaning to ourselves and would take that thing that is most beautiful about us, our compassion, and use it as a weapon against us to make us do things that we wouldn't otherwise do. It's self-invalidating and abrogates any terms of responsibility or mutual caring that might have seemed to existed in the relationship. I've had two experiences with this myself, one directly and one as kind of a bystander, and one is directly comparable. The other is just a very minor league version of the same thing. But when I was in high school and in college, I had a friend who was bipolar, and he became very dependent, not just on me, but on other people. And he needed, in order to stave off whatever was happening to him, constant company. And so he would call and talk on the phone for hours and hours and hours. And if he said, look, I have to go. Look, I have homework to do. Look, I have dinner to get to. Look, I have a date. Look, I have a meeting. Anything. He would get very upset and say, no, please don't. Please don't go. And I would let myself be guilted into staying on the phone. And I got to the point where I wasn't really listening anymore after a certain amount of time. And he was somebody I liked very much. But I did feel resentful after a bit. And it got so I could read, and I would just listen for the pauses in what he was saying. Mm-hmm, 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 turn the page. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, turn the page. And sometimes I would respond in the wrong places or not answer a yes or no question with a yes or no. I'd just say, uh-huh, yeah, I agree completely, whatever it was. And I would have to backtrack really quickly. Oh, yeah, Nazis are bad. Yeah, no, when I said Nazis were good, I didn't mean that they were. When I said yes, I didn't mean, yes, I agree with Nazis. And what it really was that I was on page 12 of a Spider-Man comic and Spidey was about to do something really interesting and I just had let my mind wander. I finally put an end to it for three different reasons. The first was, I began to observe that it was not reciprocal at all. If I ever wanted to talk about problems that I might be going through, he generally mocked them as being insignificant or unimportant or trivial. And if, say, I was having trouble in a relationship, that's because I was ugly or stupid or unattractive. So that was cheerful. Second, I didn't like myself very much when I was doing the things I just described. Not listening, just letting the phone go, being able to like put it down, walk away, come back. I felt like a jerk, even though there was no other functional way to go about my life. And that fed into the third part, which was that my life was in danger of not being my own anymore because I had to be at the beck and call of this person who would threaten to harm themselves if I did not devote something like 6 hours a day to the maintenance of their time. He knew where I lived. And at one point, there was a moment where, had I not acted, the phone calls would have ceased to be phone calls and would have been instead spontaneous, uninvited personal appearances. And then there would never be any escaping. And there wouldn't even be reading a magazine while you were talking on the phone because the problem would be confronting me all the time tumbling out of cabinet, staring out of the refrigerator when I went to get a glass of milk, and standing in the bathtub when I pulled back the shower curtain. And that was when I terminated the relationship. And I regretted it because, again, I liked the person very much. He was very smart, very creative, very talented. And yet, I realized that that person didn't care about me at all. At about the same time, I was introduced to a young woman who had suddenly appeared in New Jersey because a college student here of my indirect acquaintance, a friend of a friend, had met her online in those very, very primitive internet chat room days and had gone out there to her far western state and insisted that she come back with him or he would harm himself. And she did. She walked out of college, dropped everything, and came 3,000 miles or so across a continent to a place where she knew no one to be almost literally a hostage to this man. And the friend who introduced me into the situation and I, we set out to help her out of that jam. And it was a very complicated situation in which I, at 18 or 19, was not fully equipped to deal and did not always come off at my best. But one thing I never understood, and at the time made me suspicious of her in a way that I was completely wrong to be, was I didn't understand how anybody would say yes. That if somebody came to you and said, drop everything or I will slit my wrists, that you didn't say, look, I feel very bad for you. I'm sorry you're in that kind of pain. No one who cared about me would ask me to do that. And so if you need help, I will point you to where you can get help. But I am staying right here, and it's been nice knowing you. And in retrospect, I think what I was seeing then is the same thing that is in these stories now, in the Deadspin story that I was referring to, which is that people's kindness and their caring, their empathy, overwhelms what would otherwise be a kind of protective self-regard. And so they allowed themselves to be exploited to a lesser or greater extent. And again, I just want to say that you don't owe that to anyone, and that there is no such thing as loving someone so much. There should be no suicide pacts. There should be no one who is so unhappy in their own life that they want to do away with themselves and would ask you to go with them. And yeah, I know you can dicker about terminal situations and euthanasia and all that jazz. We're not talking about that. We're talking about relationship stuff. We're talking about friend stuff and boyfriend-girlfriend stuff or girlfriend-girlfriend stuff or boyfriend-boyfriend stuff, every variation that you can possibly imagine. It doesn't matter. I believe I've said this before on the show, so forgive me for repeating myself. When I was young and romantic and sentimental in an idiotic way, I used to think that true love meant caring about someone more than you did yourself. It was only later, in part because of experiences like these, that I realized that love is caring about someone else as much as you care about yourself. And that when your relationship with someone else puts those values in conflict, caring about them, caring for yourself, it's a very bad, serious warning sign. No one who loved you, who truly cared about you, would ask you to demean yourself for their benefit. And I don't care what the benefit is. Partners make sacrifices for each other sometimes, sure. There's an alternative version of that story that I told you, some other reality, where a couple fell in love as a result of meeting online, and one said, look, I don't feel like I can leave New Jersey, but would you come out here and be with me? And maybe she would have said, yes, I'll transfer. Or, look, we'll do this on a long-distance basis until I can graduate, and then, sure, I'm willing to go out there. That stuff happens all the time, and it's beautiful. But there's nothing you can have from someone that you have to get on the basis of coercion that's worth anything. And there's nothing that you can give a person that comes out of your being coerced that is going to be a benefit to you. For one thing, you've just opened the door to further degradation. First, it's pictures, and then it's money, and then who knows what it is. And how do you get your life back at that point? It's one of those things where, as much as you might care, you can't start. And what they ultimately do or do not do as a result of your refusing them is not your responsibility. The very fact that they asked absolves you. Maybe we'll talk about this subject another time. Maybe we won't. Until then, I'll be back with David Roth after these words are non-words from our sponsor. See you on the other side. The musical Falsettos starts with the song Four Jews in a Room Bitching. We're short two Jews, so we'll have to bitch twice as much. It's David Roth. How are you, David?
I'm good. You have to prepare me for shit like that, man. That's very good.
You'll appreciate this because I've been kind of obsessed with that show lately. I'd never seen it. It's been around for a long time, but it was revived last year. And a few weeks back, PBS showed it in its entirety. And the plot, we don't have to get into the plot, which involves marriage and someone in a heterosexual marriage realizing they're homosexual and the disruption of their family. And it's almost sung through completely like an opera. But there's a song in the middle of it involving a therapist and a kid who's having anxiety. And the therapist says, when the kid is kind of freaking out, he says, "Stop, look around you. No one is yelling at you. If you can feel all right for 10 minutes, you can feel all right for 20 minutes. If you can feel all right for 20 minutes, you can feel all right for 40 minutes. So why not drop it and feel all right for the rest of your life?" And I went, is that a real thing? And I actually asked my therapist about this, and she said, yeah, it's kind of a behavioral therapy, because people who are trying to get out of the rut of depression or anxiety, they don't get that instant gratification. And so what you try to do is kind of expand the parameters, the island of good feeling that they might have, just by increments until you've gotten some significant bulk of time where they can actually function. And it was so wonderful to find that in a song and say, you know, maybe I can use this a little bit.
Yeah, that's not the story. I mean, not to say that you can't learn anything from listening to songs or whatever, but the idea of it, I'm getting an authentic life hack instead of like some insights into the human spirit. Like, yeah, you know, you get those sometimes, or like something that gets stuck in your head. But yeah, something that you can use. It is funny though, when you were saying it, I was like, this is probably too easy to actually work, but like, I should try that. See how it goes. 10 minutes seems like a long time. Like, start with 5. But like, yeah, the rest of it definitely sounds compelling.
Yeah, exactly. And anything that anybody tells you about overcoming those kinds of situations, whether it's depression or anxiety or any kind of mental unhappiness, anything anybody tells you risks being glib and risks being almost insulting. And when in my 30s this kind of came to stay for me, I had a relative who said to me, like, you just need to puff up your chest and keep your chin in the air and have a stiff upper chin and upper lip and go out there and fight, kick its ass. It's not like that. You know, I've also had cancer and people telling me to kick cancer's ass. I got to be friends with Kevin Goldstein because he told me to kick cancer's ass. And at that moment, that was a great message. And it's one that you can kind of use. But the thing about depression is that it's invulnerable to ass kicking. It's almost the polar opposite of the advice you should give to somebody.
Right. It's not a negotiation. Like, if it was, all you do is negotiate. It's like, you don't have a counterparty that listens to you or cares about what you're doing and can be dealt with in a rational way. So it's like the idea that somehow you're losing to it is like, that's the thing that depression is telling you every moment anyway.
Right. That's exactly. That's perfectly well said. Like, you're getting all this junk mail from your psyche, and the title is "You're a Loser," or everything
it's like
sucks.
Negative political advertising. David Roth says he's America's most beloved sports writer. The facts suggest otherwise.
Right. The facts suggest that David Roth shouldn't even bother getting out of bed today.
Yeah.
And that's a very easy message to listen to. Somebody tells you to kick cancer's ass, and that's great, because what you're asking is for an act of physical stamina, which is going to be necessary if you're going to go through chemo or surgery or anything. And that is like, you can almost be the comic book hero summoning up the extra ounce of strength to lift yourself off the ground when the bad guy's beating you down. But again, depression has already beaten you down. You already feel like you're on the ground. So somebody telling you that you need to be tougher, just rub salt in the wound, basically.
I mean, it's honestly also, for me, I'm not the guy that should be getting anybody advice on how to deal with this particular disorder, because besides dealing with it constantly, I don't deal with it especially effectively. But it's all, for me, like, it's always just taking it a little bit easier on myself that seems to actually do it, not the idea of, like, squaring up and, you know, whatever, going toe-to-toe with the shit. It's just, like, reminding myself that I don't need to feel terrible about stuff all the time, and I don't need to do things that I know are going to make me upset, or that, like, I do, and instantly they make me feel, like, weak or bad. You know, like, that it's, I mean, I guess some of that is tough, too, because those become habits, but Anyway, a lot of baseball talk today.
I was about to say, and speaking of feeling bad, welcome to Election Day 2017.
Oh, God, it just gets better.
Well, I'm very grateful because today, I mean, we'll have a couple more months to go either way, but here in New Jersey, the reign of Chris Christie will finally come to an end.
Yeah, he can finally lean into his destiny, which is just getting fucking owned in public every time he goes out to get a sandwich every day for the rest of his life. That's what he's got coming, and he deserves nothing less.
It's an interesting personality thing where, we will get to sports and baseball in a moment, I promise. It's an interesting personality thing where somebody is rejected by the public for the things that they've done, and then go out of their way to double down on that. Whether toadying up to Trump in the aftermath of the primaries last year, or appearing on a beach at a time when the beaches were shut down due to a snarl that he created with the legislature over pretty much nothing. And it was just kind of a middle finger to everyone in the state, both people who voted for him and people who didn't. And it bespeaks a very small and petty personality.
Oh, yeah. But it is like, it's a towering pettiness. It's like, it's a smallness that is itself somehow unbelievably vast. But yeah, I mean, that's all it is. This is all he's about is bullshit. It's all he's ever been about. And I mean, I think he had ambitions. I think he realized, his whole value proposition as a presidential candidate was the Trump thing. It was the guy that's like putting a finger in Jeb's chest and calling him a sissy or whatever. And they just, there was a guy that was better at being an asshole and more famous than him that wound up running. And so that was it. But like, at least like Palin, like just quit being governor when she realized that all she wanted to do was really be on TV. Like, I feel like Christie stayed on as governor strictly to stick it to everybody.
Or nothing more lucrative presented itself. And
yeah,
in her case, she had opportunities at least. He's not a sportscaster. He's not necessarily somebody that you want to turn on a television set and see taking up some good deal of your screen because he really is anti-charismatic.
There's that. But I think he's also like the demographic that he appeals to, which is this like, I think of them as like North Jersey Catholic high school football dads.
Yes.
Like, not that the men themselves are Catholic, but that they are like, they attend Catholic high school football games, even if they have no rooting interest for them. They just go there to like watch Don Bosco and like talk about how undisciplined the quarterback is and how they need a pocket passer and whatever. You can hear the quotes going up everywhere around every word. Like, those dudes are, they are themselves the least appealing people that you could hope to meet. That these like kind of like braggadocious orthodontist guys that just resentful that somehow like they're not better recognized for their genius in their own time. He is of that group, the sort of thing where like I think a lot of people, once you start trying to make that pitch to a broader audience, a lot of people are like, well, those guys are actually, that's a terrible way to be. Like, why would I want to vote for or hang out with or, you know, have my policy dictated to me by somebody like that?
So we found our way to football somehow through that.
Yeah.
And that brings me to your current gig. And I haven't talked to you since you took this position. So allow me, first of all, to congratulate you on joining the venerable publication Deadspin.
Thank you.
You've written many things for them since joining them, but I feel like the one that I got the most joy out of, at least, and not that that's a comment on any of the others, was your ranking of national pizza chains in the wake of Papa John saying that his profits had declined because of the NFL protest movement.
That was done through a rigorous internal polling of the site staff. I made a spreadsheet. So there was like 16 votes cast. I wouldn't say that the results are unassailable. Like any poll that ends with Domino's on top is probably got some questions that could be asked about it. And yet, like, I don't know, Domino's, I have a Proustian fondness for that far. I mean, it's terrible pizza and I'm aware of that. And there's no reason to get it if you live in a place like New York or New Jersey where basically every pizza is better than that. But I eat a lot of it in my youth. So it was like after a travel team basketball game or coming back from North Arlington. That's 9:45 or something like that. And I hadn't really eaten dinner. That was the option. And so we would just get that. And, you know, I'd eat that with my parents in the kitchen. And that was like, so I have some fond memories of it. And then it also is less bad than it was. Papa John himself is kind of a weird, like an anti-muse figure for me, like in the way that all the people that I most enjoy writing about are like these kind of like repellent cartoon characters that somehow have like billions of dollars and a ton of power over people's lives. So he's, I guess he sort of fits within that. I mean, he doesn't write laws, but he did take like a thing that is, I think, objectively a good in in pizza and then somehow make it into like this crappy money-making gambit. So yeah, I resent that on his part.
See, I used to order a lot of Domino's too, and for the reason that before there was Domino's, if you wanted to have a pizza delivered on Saturday night, you would call your local pizza shop, your family-owned pizza shop, which, as you said, in New York and New Jersey, there's one literally every corner, every strip mall. You don't need to ever go to a chain to find a decent pizza. But the thing was that they were not equipped for kind of modern-age delivery. So you'd call and say, can I get a pizza delivered, you know, Saturday night at 7 o'clock? And they'd say, sure, that'll be 3 hours. Because you had to wait. So Domino's, whoever, you know, invented Domino's, recognizing there was a market inefficiency there to go all money ball on this thing, said, well, we'll have a guarantee of 30 minutes or less. And it doesn't matter what the pizza tastes like at that time. And it tasted like upholstery.
Yeah.
But it would show up without your having to order it at 4 in the afternoon to get it there at dinner time. So definitely when I was in high school, we used to order a lot of it just because we knew it would get there. And then their drivers were driving recklessly and so forth. So they suspended permanently that the 30-minute thing, or it's free, at which point the reason to order them evaporated. And within that, the Darwinistic pizza competition, some of the local guys, recognizing the existential threat that that guarantee poised, had sped up a little bit. So instead of 3 hours, it was one. And maybe you could live with that.
I mean, it's funny, though. I know people that are Papa John's defenders. Some of my best friends are Papa John's defenders, which never feels good to say. But it's because of the fact that they live in, you know, pizza deserts where they grew up and, you know, or spent a great deal of time there, where it's just like when Papa John's opens, like, it's authentically the best pizza in town, because, like, the one pizzeria that there is like, just they never knew what they were doing, and they've been there forever, and they're not trying to get any better. I think with, yeah, I mean, to the extent that you could, I guess, like, think about Domino's as a driver of progress, it's in, you know, making more efficient the delivery process. I don't think anyone would say that aesthetically they move the ball down the field at all.
As I told you online, I found myself, because my wife is from there in Mississippi, in the middle of nowhere, and there was a Papa John's and a Waffle House, and basically fried po' boys of trash fish of uncertain origin from the local effluent canal or whatever. So in that setting, Papa John's was actually kind of a godsend. That little bucket of salty garlic goo that they give you was incredibly appealing in that setting. And I had a good feeling about them. And I really can't judge whether they were actually good at that time or it's just that everything else was so frighteningly bad.
Yeah.
And I was so convinced that anything that we bought was going to be delivered by somebody in a Klan hood. And eventually they did come to New Jersey. And it was, to quote what you wrote, eating a Papa John slice is like chomping down on a piece of oil-flavored chewing gum, but somehow much worse for your breath. It's pizza that tastes the way long-distance bus travel feels. And then I really love this one. Papa John's pizza tastes like traffic and feels like allergies.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think any of that is unfair. Like, I stand by what I said. But at the same time, like, I guess I could have added the caveat, and relatively speaking, it is not significantly worse than, like, all of which could also be said about all of the other ones. I'm going to actually, tomorrow, for a video thing that will eventually, I assume, appear on Deadspin, unless I'm really upsetting in it, I'm going to taste all of the different pizzas that appear on that ranking.
Yeah,
it's great. One of our writers is coming up from Philadelphia, and is going to be in it. And he's like, I can't believe I'm coming up from Philadelphia to eat pizza in New York, and it's going to be like Papa John's and Sbarro and freaking Little Caesars. But it's the world we live in. The internet demands content, and more specifically, it demands content in which I'm upset. And I'm here to deliver on that. I'm called to do it.
Steve here, interrupting with my usual conversation stopper, to say that David and I will be back with more right after this break. We could have a long conversation about the fact that the claim that Papa John made in terms of his declining profits is demonstrably false, and just how much punching down it is to jump on these protests that the NFL players are staging about the unequal treatment before the law or via police officers that African Americans sometimes get, and how small it is to blame your declining profits on them. It's bandwagoning in the worst way. So it's wonderful that they then had to disclaim neo-Nazis adopting their pizza in the aftermath of that. But I think we both know how we feel about that.
Yeah.
But I had a broader question about this, and it actually goes to the food quality. It's this. Why do we accept as Americans, and this is less of a problem for you living in New York, where you have as many restaurants and good restaurants, and even good restaurants that won't cost you like your mortgage, in a narrow area such that you never have to patronize any of these places. But why do we accept from national chains, and it doesn't have to be pizza, it could be Olive Garden, which squats like the Cthulhu monster at the end of Stranger Things, you know, over Times Square. It could be Red Lobster. It could be Applebee's, which is, there's one across the street from my house and I don't go there. It would be the most convenient thing in the world for me to do if it was actually good, but it's scary bad. And it's like, why do we accept such a mediocre level of product? You know, you pointed out in your piece that these purveyors of pizza actually disdain their customers by evidence of the product that they sell. And we just take that. And these places proliferate all over the country. And sometimes they do well and sometimes they don't. But it's strange that we just go and we expect to have a bad time and have bad food. And we put up with that.
It's hard to answer this question without getting into some extremely crude Marxism on my part. But I think that a lot of it is that. I mean, that it's just like, this is the result of every downward pressure in, you know, market incentive that there is, that like, it's not just that it's disdain for the customer, it's disdain for the product. I think this is the thing where like Domino's, to a certain extent, that like ad campaign that they ran in like 2010 or 11, where they were like, we suck, like, got to admit it, like, yep, pizza got real bad. And then, so they did that, they like redid their stores so they didn't look so much like a fucking underworld movie, like in terms of the lighting. And they, like, I think then they were like, our pizza's good now. Whether that's true or not, obviously, is highly debatable. But it is one of those things where, like, at least that was like a, I mean, Papa John's whole argument is based on quality too. But like a little bit of self-respect, like a little bit, and also like a little bit of respect for the people that work there. Any of that, I think, goes a long way. Like, I have to believe that you can taste a sort of difference in that regard. That, like, not that Domino's is an example. Because, again, I haven't had it in a couple of years.
But you will.
I will. In the next 24 hours, I will have changed that. So this is a really exciting time for us, this liminal space in which we're having this conversation. Like, with any of that stuff, I think that, like, food is a, obviously it's a necessity, but it is, there's an element of performance to it. And there's an element of, you know, it's a communal thing. It's, you know, like a thing that people enjoy together, a thing that's like prepared in teams. It's expressive. And you can tell when it is expressing disdain, or when it is conceived of with disdain, or when it's conceived of with no higher purpose than like being just like sort of traded for the amount of money agreed upon in advance. I think that's true at fancy restaurants sometimes too. I mean, that like, man, when it's missing, you really notice it. And it's depressing, the idea that, like, you know, in New York, a lot of it is very expensive. My wife and I cook a lot. It's become a thing that as we get old and lame and our friends all have children, and so we can't see them on weeknights anymore. That like cooking has replaced some of that, but it is like, it's a thing that we do that brings a little bit of pleasure into our lives, where like otherwise it could be just like sort of a null set. Like, we could eat oatmeal for dinner every night too and still get our recommended daily allowances of whatever it is that, you know, we're supposed to be getting.
I admit that my wife and I have done that at times when like the kids had whatever they had and they were taken care of, and then we go, God, it's 10 o'clock and we haven't eaten yet. I've done that sometimes. At least it's not unhealthy.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, but that's, you know, what is the deal that you've struck with yourself when you're eating dinner and going, at least it's not unhealthy, right? I mean, like, that's kind of, it's, you have not won that negotiation. You have, in fact, been defeated by yourself, more accurately by your children, obviously, which I'm sure happens constantly. It happens every time I go visit my niece and nephew, and I don't even live there. So I think it's just a question of, again, like, being kind to yourself. Like, treat yourself to something a little bit like better than that. You're probably worth more than like an Applebee's quesadilla eaten, you know, via delivery.
And again, we don't do that. But your options in at least my part of the suburbs, my part of New Jersey, are very constricted by that.
Oh, yeah.
And by the fact that those businesses have crowded out, I guess, the more sort of organic ones. And even they're saying that, risks falling into a trap, because one of the whole reasons that national chains proliferated in the first place is that the quality of the old non-chain restaurants was so uneven. And you didn't know if, say, you weren't from the neighborhood, if you were driving down the highway, you didn't know when you stopped off at such and such cafeteria or such and such luncheonette, you didn't know what you were going to get. And it could be evil bad.
Right.
And they seem to have stopped making these. But for somebody who doesn't really cook very much or very well, I like watching cooking shows sometimes. And I really enjoy the ones where Robert Irvine or Gordon Ramsay goes into some greasy spoon somewhere in the country and is confronted with a refrigerator full of mold and eggs that were purchased in 1892 and things. They have to correct these people. But the thing is, the very fact that they would have to correct them in the first place suggests that even if they redo the place, it would never, ever be safe to eat there no matter what, because they have not the foggiest clue about how to cook or food safety.
Or any care for it. I mean, that's the part of it that's always like kind of amazing about those. It's like the opposite of the diners, drive-ins, and dives thing, where it's like people running these like humble places selling fairly inexpensive food, but they're like putting their whole being into it and they're proud of how good it is. The idea of just like knowing that there are, for every one of those places, probably like five or six just like basically haunted houses, but they're, you know, like just waiting for you to enter and be like, how bad could it be? Kate and I had this experience driving back through Connecticut one time, and we stopped at a deli. It's like a Jewish deli, and it was like, you know, a lot of kitsch going on. Like, there's like a whole story on the placemat, and there's like a cartoon of the guy, and he looks like Bernie Coppell from The Love Boat. And you're just like, oh, my, you know, like, I've had a lot of meals in places like that, so I assumed it would be fine. And it sucked. It just sucked. They didn't get the order right. Everything's bad. Like, we've got lox and eggs, which is like, to me, one of the best things that you could eat. And like, they somehow fuck both of it up.
And you can't. Even I can make that. I mean,
it's really hard. You just make scrambled eggs and put the salty fish in it, man. Like, it's not, it wasn't an omelet. It was like a thing. But like, with something like that, like, so obviously, whatever, like, lesson learned. Not like we're going to be like super famished outside of Hartford anytime soon, like, Lord willing. But the idea of like places that don't care about it, like, yeah, like, not to say that, you know, we wouldn't have been psyched to go to a Subway instead of that place, but we would have had a better experience.
What puts me off of Subway, I really have a thing with places that have open food prep areas where you can see the flies crawling through the food they're about to give you.
Yeah.
Like, that's not appealing to me. I have the same problem with Chipotle, and that Chipotle keeps demonstrating itself as kind of the bacteria capital of the world seems to justify that approach on my part.
Chipotle is interesting. Like, I like it pretty well, but it is the sort of, I don't eat it very much because it's like, if I ate a lot of Chipotle, I think my lifestyle would suffer for it. but my rock and roll lifestyle, but the vibe of Chipotle, where again, like, they're trying to sort of like perform some sort of pride in the stuff that they're making, where they're paying the people that are making it like slightly better than they'd be getting paid if they were working, you know, at Taco Bell. Like, that is, I'm just enough of an idiot. And, you know, I get hungry at the same times every day. Like every now and then that'll work for me. Like, that was something I saw about Chipotle recently, that they apparently were, I think it was Bank of America, downgraded their stock because they thought that they were paying their employees too much.
That's lovely.
Yeah, but they were just like, there's all this profit, like, sitting there on the table. Like, why are you giving these guys $9 an hour when you could be giving them $7.45? Which, again,
they don't spit in the food that way.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's basically all it is, right? They work, people work a little bit harder when they feel like they're respected, when they feel like what they're, I mean, that's the whole, like, the idea of, like, a sandwich artist at Subway. Like, I mean, whatever you need to tell yourself, but, like, I would call myself a sandwich artist if I, you know, like, was making sandwiches for 8 hours a day, because, like, that's, you take it seriously. It's your job. It's your work. Like, if you're respected in it, like, if you're respected by your boss and you feel like they're making something that's good, like, I think you'll do a better job. When it comes off like a joke, when you go into like one of those Subways that's like, you know, like underlit and kind of like these like depressing wan pink circles of meat.
Yes.
You know exactly what you're getting. Everybody knows exactly what they're selling you. Like, that's a fucking drag, man.
I never worked fast food myself, but I had friends who did it in junior high and high school. I mean, this is getting on 30 years ago. But they'd come back and say, like, oh, yeah, a customer was rude to us, so we put Windex in his coffee. Things like that. Or, you know, somebody was rude to us, so I gave him two hamburger buns filled with lettuce and just left the meat on the cutting board. So the guy drove away with his lettuce sandwich, not understanding why. But, you know, again, if it was a real job, you would never do that. I couldn't say to you, like, my best friend is the vice president of AT&T, and we decided to unplug the Eastern Seaboard today because it would be funny. Like, that wouldn't happen. Or maybe it does. I don't know.
Well, that's the whole thing. Like, none of it's happened yet, but, like, we're clearly in a different space now. But, yeah, no, I mean, that's the other thing, too, with, like, trusting teens to do stuff for you. Like, I mean, it's important that we have teens. It's a necessary age. You can't just skip it. This all goes chronologically, as you know, of course. God damn, that doesn't mean they should be allowed to, like, do things like prepare food for people.
I had a cat who really liked Dunkin' Donuts products, and...
This is a good... Sentence is off to a great start, Steve.
He liked it better than we did, and I had a friend who worked there, and at the end of his shift, they would kind of throw out everything they hadn't sold, so we would just bring back muffins and feed them to the cat. I mean, it says something for Dunkin' Donuts products, at least at that time, that was not what offed the cat. Eventually, it was another thing. It wasn't morbid obesity or just
cat
general
diabetes.
Toxic shock. Yeah, it wasn't any of those things. It was almost a lab experiment in retrospect, so take that for what it's worth. I want to ask you about the World Series, and I hope...
Really?
Not,
why? Go ahead.
If it's not unbearable for me to read another passage back to you, you wrote this for the Victory Journal, and then later it showed up at Deadspin. This was, I think, written partway through the World Series, and obviously you were enjoying it. And you wrote that, and this is very perspicacious, even by the standards of other American institutions, baseball has a difficult time with its past. Moments of shame and pride jostle over the last century and change, a time during which baseball came to see and sell itself as an irreplaceable American thing. One of America's first and bloodiest principles is that nothing is irreplaceable, and baseball has been outpaced and possibly outmoded by the NFL and perhaps the NBA. But baseball, which insists upon seeing itself as a prime slab of corn-fed, old-style Americana, dorky and a little heavy on the pageantry, seems to have ceded the present. But this postseason is something different. American institutions do not characteristically embrace progress gladly, and the way in which baseball has been pried open hasn't always been easy to watch, but this World Series has shown what the future of the game might look like once the past is finally put where it belongs. So I have two questions for you about that, and I know it's bad to ask two questions at once, but I'm going to do that.
Oh,
one,
okay,
is, did you write that before or after the Gurriel Asian racist parodying moment, which got so much attention? And two, now that the series is over, do you still feel that way?
It was, I started writing that in Game 3, and it ran after Game 5. So the Gurriel Darvish thing was some of the not always easy to watch. I think this was a wonderful World Series. I think the Gurriel thing sucked, and I hated how it was handled, and it made me sad. But I also feel like it's the sort of thing where, in the fullness of time, it has the potential to be a teachable sort of moment. It's also the sort of thing that's going to happen as the game gets as diverse as it is now. I mean, that, like, it's ugly and it's stupid, and he should have missed games in the World Series. The fact that he authentically seemed to feel bad about it, I don't know what that counts for, but the people that were jeering Jackie Robinson would not have been as aware that what they were doing was wrong. It's hard. I mean, like, this is what something that the game is going to have to go through. Like, when Yao Ming came to the NBA, like, Shaq did a lot of, like, ching chong bullshit on the mic and thought he was being funny, and reporters laughed. You know, I mean, I think that's the way that all of this stuff goes. Nobody's, like, just going to get shit right. But to me, the idea of, you know, that, I don't think totally put the whole World Series in the crapper. Did you think it did?
No, I don't think it did, but as you said, the way that it was handled bothered me, in that baseball always takes a side, right? I mean, people say that baseball shouldn't be politicized, but you have the Bush father and son throwing out balls, and in a way an endorsement of a particular point of view. You always have a military presence. You have the national anthem and God Bless America. And so there's always an endorsement of a certain kind of Americanism. And then there is another kind of Americanism, a kind that doesn't accept the kind of thing that Gurriel does and wants to see a stronger response to it. And that's the one that's always downplayed. And that's the one that it's always not the right time, that the punishment should be down the road somewhere. It's not dissimilar in a way. And I don't want to take what was a very trivial incident and compare it to a tragedy or a series of tragedies. But it's not different in that way from the way that when there's one of these mass shooting things that politicians will say, well, now is not the time to politicize gun rights. And it's a question of when is the right time.
Right. And I mean, that's just a way of not answering a question.
It's a way of kicking it down the road to when passions are cooler and no one's going to really fight back. When you decouple what happened to Gurriel from the moment that, or what Gurriel did, and decouple it from the moment in which it happened and say, like, oh, he's going to miss 5 games in April the same way that he might have missed 5 games in April because he had a head cold or a hangnail. Right. The connection is no longer there. You lost the opportunity to take a stand in the same way that saying now is not the time. But I will take a stand at a date to be named later. No, you won't.
And also the moment has passed. Like, that's one of those things where, like, when you screw it up like that in that moment, it makes possible, because you're signaling what you do and don't take seriously. That, like, you take the pageantry seriously, you don't take the diversity of the league and making sure that it's an accepting and tolerant, all these, like, fucking liberal arts college words. But, like, that's it. That's what it has to be. Like, it's a workplace and you have to have people treating each other with respect in it. Doesn't mean everybody's always going to be nice. But it's the sort of thing where, like, you have to, if that is a value that you profess, then it has to be a value that you live out. And in this case, like, the stuff that broke my heart about the Gurriel bit was there was an image that somebody had, and then there was people I saw tweeting that they saw kids doing the same gesture in the stands, like when Gurriel was batting or, like, yes, when Darvish was pitching. And, like, that is just, it's the sort of thing where, like, you only get one chance to make clear that that is unacceptable, right? Like, and obviously that's on those kids' parents, and, like, they hope that they told them to stop. But, and it's not, and Rob Manfred is not his job to raise these children or whatever, but it is his job to exemplify and, like, act out through his, you know, actions what the values of the league are. And, like, and in this case, he tried to duck the shit, and, like, that is not something that can necessarily be put back in the tube.
It was not just kids, it was adults. And when Gurriel homered in a subsequent game, they were making those gestures as if to say, like, that shows you. It's not even like, well, he may be a jerk, but he's our jerk. Like, I could almost kind of understand that.
It's a meme at that point, right? It's the way that, like, a lot of memes, like, the way that, like, trash memes at the end of their life cycle on Twitter or whatever, they're not there to amuse or, like, delight anyone. It's just a way of, like, showing something. You're like, I know what this is. Like, this is Harambe, the gorilla that was shot. Like, so here it is. Right. And then other people look at it and they're like, I also know that that's Harambe, the gorilla that was shot. There's no amusement in it. There's no light in it. The purpose of it is to signal something and to say, like, I know what this is. But, I mean, the problem with that is accepting a meme as, like, a neutral thing is that you wind up with some really fucked up stuff that you're just like, well, they didn't mean it. Like, it's just a frog in a Nazi helmet. Like, it's just the way that they communicate with each other. Like, if that gesture is the sort of thing, like, the way that, like, Yankee fans do the thumbs down after, like, Todd Frazier drives in a run, like, fine, that's a meme too. But that's, like, a cool, funny meme that everybody can enjoy. Right. It's, like, rooted in a thing, and it's fundamentally, like, kind of positive and neat. Like, in this case, like, if that's going to become Gurriel's signature, I think he would probably feel bad about that. But also, like, goddamn, like, how are you an adult with, like, a job and a family pulling that gesture in public in 2017 and, like, thinking that it's okay? I thought it was kids. I didn't realize it was adults who was doing it, too. That's really bad, man.
Well, adults are kids now, but vice versa. But
right. Yes.
I think that meme is, I mean, it's not just like they're communicating or signifying their allegiance to whatever the hell it is that they stand for, but it's also a way of saying, I see your values and I don't give a fuck about your values. And in this case, being anyone who would object to Gurriel making that gesture or thinking that it's worthwhile of an instantaneous punishment or any punishment. And that is a huge problem when we have that kind of gap between us, not just in terms of baseball, but in terms of the body politic in general. And maybe this is a jejune cliche point to make, but there's no way of ever bridging any gap between any two groups of people or any two singular people. Imagine if you conducted your relationships that way with your wife or girlfriend or best friend or male or female, whoever, and they said, you know, I really care about A, and you said, I don't care about A. I'm not even going to hear you about A. I'm not going to acknowledge that. In fact, I'm going to take A and wave it in front of your face and taunt you with it. It could be like your wife comes home today and says, David, you've been leaving your socks on the bedroom floor and I hate seeing them. Dirty socks are ugly. And then, you know, you spent the next week going, look, dirty socks, haha, dirty socks. That's a good way to get divorced, right? So why would you do that on a broader cultural basis?
The one point of that I would clarify in what I think was not a jejun and a, you know, pretty, I mean, obvious but worth making point that you just made, is that I could be friends with someone and not care about everything that they care about, but I have to if I'm going to be friends with them, or if I'm going to work with them, or if I'm going to exist with them in the same environment, I have to understand that the thing that they care about is authentically, one, a thing that they care about, and two, like, meaningful enough for them that it deserves a certain amount of respect. Like, it's obviously there's differences here. Like, if they really care about, like, phrenology and the differences between the races, then, like, I would just at that point not be associated with that person and maybe mention it to HR if it got real bad. But it's that inability to accept that other people's concerns are real, or that other people are ever arguing in bad faith, in good faith, like presuming bad faith, or presuming that other people are somehow just, you're wrong. Like, if it's not real to me, then it can't possibly be real to you. That's the sort of thing where, like, when I get real dark about the culture or our politics or whatever, it's that, like, I don't know what it takes at this point to drag people to the realization that, like, these concerns, that if it's not real to you, if it's not your experience, that does not inherently make the experience false. It does not immediately mean that the experience is unrepresentative of anybody else's lived experience. It just means that, like, you as a white guy are less likely to get shot and killed by a police officer during a routine traffic stop. If you're like, well, that's never happened to me, and I don't even know anybody that that's happened to, that's a way that your experience is signaling to you that you should listen to what the other person is saying. Because, like, not every experience that exists in the world is the same as yours. This is a very difficult thing for some people, even adults, to fucking grasp. And it's so frustrating to think about how you can have a politics that works with people deluded in that way. You then individually need to offer to do what Hillary did to a certain extent, which is to take everybody's little slices of experience and say, that's true and I agree with you and I believe you. That's true and I agree with you and I believe you. That's true and I agree with you and believe you, which is good. It's better than saying, than pretending those people don't exist. It doesn't unite anybody in any way. It's just, like, further slicing this down into a series of experiences that are walled off from each other.
It looks phony because then you're trying to be all things to all people. Mm-hmm. But the problem is you want everything to be reciprocal, right? So everything that you were saying about accepting the validity of other people's beliefs and experiences is necessary to communicate. The problem is that we can't even get there because one side might say, I believe that Gurriel made a racist gesture that deserves condemnation, or I believe that global warming is real. And then the other side says, I believe that Hillary Clinton and the DNC are pimping children out of a pizzeria in Washington.
Yeah.
So how do you even say, like, okay, well, I respect your viewpoint. You can't. You can't even, you haven't gotten to go, let alone Marvin Gardens on the Monopoly board. I don't know how you do that.
I think that the way that we wind up getting sidetracked before we even get to that is that if you were to say, I believe that Gurriel did something stupid and should be censured for it, and then the response to that is not reacting to the thing that happened, but reacting to your reaction to it, I think that that's where you wind up going in circles and winding up with nothing improving or changing. Because I think that's, like, really more where the politics is now, that, like, the idea of making an objective statement, or even just a statement that you're making in good faith based on your experience, and if the other person's response to it is not to the object but to the reaction, then you're not going to figure this shit out. You're just going to be, like, saying, that's so typical of you that you would get upset about Gurriel's doing some dumb childish thing with his eyes when, and then you put in whatever thing it is that you're worried about. And then, you know, the circle that is created there is then, you know, naturally the response from you would be like, why are you changing the subject back to the thing that you want to talk about, blah, blah, blah. Again, it's just like, that's not discourse. That's, like, just a series of, I don't know, it's a Twitter spat.
Like, is about the most useless thing that you can get involved with. I do want to conclude the World Series thought on a happier note. I think what you wrote also dovetails nicely with something else you wrote about Yasiel Puig. I assume that that was also in response to a lot of people sniping at Puig for the bat-licking, bat-flipping sort of exuberant way that he plays the game, one which, to be fair, he hasn't always earned in terms of his performance on the field, although his performance on the field for the most part in the postseason, he went a little cold in the World Series, but it was mostly very good, very exciting. I found the eccentricities endearing, if hard to relate to, particularly the bat licking. And it seems to me like we've come a long way from just two falls ago when Jose Bautista had this big home run against the Rangers in the ALCS and had this bat flip, which seemed like it took 5 minutes from the time you flipped the bat till the time it came down. And that ended up being a brawl with the Rangers the next spring or the next May when Rougned Odor punched him. And
yeah, they argued about that shit for 2 years.
And even this year, there was a bench clearing incident with him in Atlanta over the same kind of behavior. But it seems to me that that's now a rear guard action, that the bat flipping guys, the expressive guys, the Puigs of the world have won. And it took me a long time to come around to this point of view, but I do think it's better for the game.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I went back when I was writing the Puig thing and I read something that I wrote for you and Mark when I was at SB Nation during the first bloom of Puig's breakout. Because this was really, the postseason was the first time in really since that first part of his career, the base of like 160 plate appearances or something in 2013. And then this was the first time he was that good since, and all the intervening time. I mean, he got sent down, he was platooned, he was benched. Like, he was not always great. And he also was not having as much fun when he was bad, right, as, of course, he wouldn't. At that time, it seemed like people were upset, not just players, but like columnists. And this time around, it's like the real dead end, like rump faction, grumpy guys like Phil Mushnick is like, unacceptable. Why did the game start so late? Why is the orange shoe so strong these days? Like, just guys, just whatever, like complaining old guys with problems whose opinions, you know, whatever you can listen to or not listen to, but there are fewer of them. It seems like at some point, like, yeah, like everybody's sort of making peace with the idea that baseball can be like expressive and fun and have this sort of like an element of performance to it beyond the, like, you know, pumping your fist once and like making, you know, refining your craft. Like, if this is what a more diverse version of baseball looks like, as we get like sluggers from Korea that are used to flipping their bats, and we get like players from Cuba that are used to playing at games that are basically like fucking rock concerts. I mean, like, just like so loud and rowdy and different. Venezuela, similar. Like, that all adds to the game. This is a point that you made to me for another piece that I wrote about, like, how baseball, it doesn't just like Americanize immigrant populations, although that's always been a thing that the game has sort of done, that it's a thing to be a fan of, it's a thing to watch, and it, you know, sort of assimilates, but it is also like it assimilates those cultures in turn. This is like the vision of baseball as an American thing that is most appealing to me because of my politics, but also that is appealing to me because, like, if it's just fucking Brian McCann's all the way down, then it's not, it could still be fun. It's a great game, but it's like, it's not going to be what it could be. Like, imagine how much cooler it could get if, like, once we cycle through the, like, the cops, basically, that are on, like, rosters now, and you get to, like, people that are actually enjoying themselves playing a game instead of, like, trying to make sure that nobody else is enjoying themselves too much. It could be very different. Like, somebody like Javi Baez, he could wind up being a million kids' favorite baseball player and never make an all-star team just because he's fucking cool. And, like, that's awesome. That's if you want baseball to succeed, like, if you want it to, or, you know, whatever, not just survive, but, like, thrive, then, like, that's what you want. You need people to, like, care about it and to want to play it and to want to watch it. That's a thing that, like, I think you can see even if Puig never becomes great, which I think he probably, I mean, most people don't, you know, like, right, even if he never becomes, like, a real superstar, that, like, he's doing something good for baseball. There was a moment in the NLCS where Puig slid into second base and Baez did one of those crazy good tags on him. You know, like, Puig was trying to reach, right, around it. And basically, like, Baez tagged three different locations before he finally got Puig. And he got him. And he did, like, a Mutombo finger wag at Puig, and Puig started laughing. And, man, it was just the coolest shit to see. It was an important baseball game, too. But it was like both of these guys were like, ah, you got me. Like, that was fun.
It's unusual to say something positive about Pete Rose in this day and age, but one of my favorite things that he's ever been associated with is in that famous Game 6 of the 1975 World Series that went extra innings, was the one that was won by Carlton Fisk with the waving the home run fair, is that when Pete Rose reached first base somewhere late in that game, he turned to whoever was playing first base, I'm blanking on at the moment, and said, "Isn't this a great game? We do need more of that."
I mean, I think that's like, it's incredible how low the bar is at this point, that it's like one of those things where, like, if you catch a guy saying, for me, the thing that I put in the lead of that Victory Journal piece was Ross Stripling, of all guys, almost giving up the grand slam that would have put a game out of reach. It was a game the Dodgers wound up not winning. The score didn't even change from when he was pitching, but it was like caught by Chris Taylor with his back to the fence, just towering. And the camera caught him afterwards, just going, wow. Like, of all the things that you could see an adult say, like, that's valuable. That's, like, meaningful. Baseball, for all of the things that it has sold itself as delivering, like, there hasn't always been, they seem a little uncomfortable with wow relative to, like, what the NBA, for instance, is, like, actively selling that part of it. It's there to sell, man. Do it.
Well, I think there's an evolution into, not to overly defend the Brian McCanns of the world, I think that that attitude in baseball came from a well-intentioned place decades, if not 100 years ago or more, because there were sort of twin aspects of the game's evolution. One is there are these gentlemen's clubs. Gentlemen do not embarrass or show up other Victorian gentlemen, so it's not sporting to pimp your home run. Once that phase ended and you're going for actual professional players, you have a lot of guys who are severe alcoholics playing this game. Like, the vast, vast majority of players are inebriated 98% of the time, and they're not necessarily educated. And so if you did pimp your home run, then the next guy might try to put the ball through your face, or might slash you with his spikes, or might just start a fight. And in order to actually complete the baseball game, you needed to clamp down on that kind of behavior and just have this no embarrassing the other guy thing. No styling, mm-hmm. no showing up. The one place where I can still see a place for it is that baseball is a game where you make an out the majority of the time. It's a game that does humble you. Even Ted Williams was out 6 to 7 times per 10 trips to the plate. If you celebrate the up moments and the other guy is celebrating the down moments, like, there's no end to it.
Right.
So I see where it came from and why it came from there. At the same time, we've legislated a lot of that behavior out of the game. You have a lot of college guys who are theoretically more educated. We control the amount of substance abuse, so there's, in theory, nobody hopped up on PCP who's going to bite your face if you pimp your home run. I think on the whole that you're right, particularly in a modern environment, baseball has done a terrible job of selling their players because they're so quiet, because the ethos, especially for those older sports writers, is Mickey Mantle running the bases in about 3 seconds on a home run with his head down as if he were embarrassed to have hit the home run. We need a different vibe now.
I mean, that's also just like, for all of that, like, those things, it's not to say that, like, the Mickey Mantle shit isn't cool. I mean, this is what's good about baseball's history, is that it's so legible relative to the other sports. You can go back, like, you do, because you know this stuff, and you've given me similar, that insight on where this behavior policing came from in the past. And it's like, it was very illuminating to me, just because, like, for me, like, baseball begins to a certain extent when I started paying attention to it. And then, like, I learned a little bit about it from reading books. It would be surprising to be like, why is everybody being such an asshole? The guy just hit a home run. He's not allowed to be happy. But, like, yeah, there's a reason for all of this. Everything leads to everything else. It's just, as with everything else, at least in 2017, there's this certain type of person that very much wants history to not just stop, but then to go back. But they also don't necessarily know what they are going back to, that there's not, like, a knowledge of history. It's just this idea that, like, it used to feel different and it used to be better. And I think the idea that, like, the quality of play in baseball, I think objectively anyone would say, is better now than, you know, that, like, it's continuing to improve, that, like, not just because of, like, training stuff or whatever, but, like, we're pulling players from more places in the world. Like, we're getting the best players, not just from, like, every, you know, high school and college being fed into the system, but the best players from, like, every country that cares about baseball eventually is making it here. So, like, this is all good. You just have to deal with, like, the fact that it's going to be different. Like, it's not going to be some, like, imaginary yeoman bumpkin thing. I mean, like, it's a city now. Like,
right.
So you have to deal, and the compromises that you make to live in a city, which is that sometimes you're a little too close to somebody. Sometimes, like, somebody's eating something that smells bad to you nearby. But, like, any of that stuff is, like, it's the price you pay for also being near all these different and new things. Like, baseball needs to get right with that. It seems like, broadly speaking, it is, but, like, it's always a process of getting over it. And I think that, like, once people accept that this is, like, even if they don't think it's fun, that this is just the way that things are, then, like, you know, then we're on to the next problem.
Last question, David. It's traditional that when we do this, we touch base with the Mets. They have retired Terry Collins and hired Mickey Callaway as their new manager. And I wonder if you can put an epitaph on the Terry Collins era.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's a tough one. It's complicated. This is a conversation that we had at Deadspin's offices and on Slack recently when we were talking about the firing of Dusty Baker, which I thought, relative to the firing of Terry Collins, was very hard for me to understand.
Yep.
And I think what it came down to, this was, I think, a point that Tim Archer made, is that nobody actually really knows what managers do. We have some sense of, like, we know what the actions are, but we don't necessarily know, like, how they're making these processes during the course of the game. And so there's a great deal of narrativizing that happens after the fact. The idea of, like, oh, you should have used analytics, oh, you should have gone with your gut, any of that shit, the same old binaries that people are going to be arguing about until we come up with something more fun to argue about. But the one thing that you can say that a manager does, because people will tell you, is that, like, they can make players have fun and play hard. That, like, they can create an environment where people are enjoying themselves and working for each other and taking care of each other and trying to win with and for each other. And, you know, that's whatever Dusty did or didn't do right in Washington, he unmistakably did that. That they went from where they were when Matt Williams was managing them to where they were when they got rid of Dusty Baker. And it's like, it's mostly the same guys. They just all seem a lot happier and they're playing a lot better. So, which counts for a lot. And I think with Terry, it went through the full cycle. This is a very, like, old line New York sports thing to let happen. I feel like you could make the case that the Yankees did that with Girardi, but I don't think it holds up as well. But it's like what the Giants did with, like, Jim Fossil or Tom Coughlin. These guys that are there to change the culture, effectively change the culture, then they stick around too long, and eventually the culture starts to change out of their control. And I think with Collins, what it was that, like, he took a team that sucked, and he got them to respect themselves a little bit more and maybe to give a little bit more effort. The team started playing very well because they got lucky for a brief period of time in a way that teams seldom do with their young pitchers coming through. And then they peaked. They had 2016 was bad luck in a lot of ways, like, but they still made the playoffs. They still tried really hard. 2017, it just didn't seem like anybody was listening to anybody else, and people were kind of checked out. And, like, that's when it's time to move on forward. So you can say that he managed to achieve the one thing that we can say that a manager achieves, and also that he won, you know, some games. But, like, yeah, I mean, it was obviously, if they had brought him back next year, it would have been ridiculous.
He got to the 2015 World Series, and it's hard to think of a manager who reaped less respect for that, had no halo associated with that at all.
Right.
And I don't know if this is that the...
He had some bad moments managing in that World Series, to be fair. But it is also weird. I mean, like, only two managers go to the World Series, and you're absolutely right. Like, he was, as soon as the next year started, everybody was like, ah, fucking Terry again. Like, which is amazing.
He sat on Michael Conforto the next season, which seemed like, you know, he was holding off the future instead of embracing it. So it was a combination of kind of organizational factors and then his own adherence to outmoded thinking. He was a guy who really rode certain arms in the bullpen, couldn't stay away from them. And that in and of itself was maybe a reason to move on.
Because at that point, he's messing with the teams. That's an investment. It's not the most important investment. I mean, I think that you can't necessarily say that, like, you know, if a pitcher is going to break, they're going to break. And a lot of the ways that Mets players broke this year, I think, owe to the training methods that the team, for typically sketchy, ridiculous reasons, having to do with the Wilpons, the idea that, like, guys are getting too buffed up and then getting hurt because they're, like, training with Jeff Wilpon's buddy in Port St. Lucie. So that's real. Like, that's happening. But certainly you can look at, like, I mean, the bullpen was gassed by May this year. You know, like, I mean, he just, like, pitched some of these guys so far into the ground that they wound up getting released. Like, guys that were useful for them the year before or the year before that. And, yeah, I mean, that's, like, again, that's one of those things that you can also point to and see, like, you know, you can tell when a manager is screwing it up, I guess. You know, not just because those pitchers start pitching worse, because, like, bullpens are volatile and relief pitchers are volatile. But, like, you can tell when a guy, it's like, if he's throwing all the damn time and he's declining, then, like, you know, like, these two things are often related in some way. And you can generally figure all that out. I mean, I don't know how he didn't.
So do you feel optimistic about Mickey Callaway? The history of pitching coaches or pitchers in general making great managers is kind of thin. Yeah. So that makes me a little nervous. And I don't feel like just because he has that background, he can wave a magic wand and heal all of the wounded in that department.
I certainly think that's true. It's hard to say. Like, I mean, I'll be optimistic about it if I think that the Wilpons are committed to trying to improve the team, but I never think that. So that's, to a certain extent, it's hard to know, you know, what to expect from Callaway or what's even fair to ask. I think that, again, though, this comes back to the thing, the one thing that we know that managers can do. And like, I don't know if he can do it, but if he can get everybody in the clubhouse to fucking respect themselves and respect each other, then like, it'll be a big improvement over where they were at the end of last year. I mean, they weren't having fun. They weren't trying hard, you know, like, and that was the case for most of the season. And I don't know why that was. I mean, I think a lot of it, you know, it's like Asdrubal Cabrera being upset because he has to play out of position. Like, he's the one person alive that still thinks he's a starting everyday shortstop in the majors. Like, some of that is like, you know, that better communication could help with that. You know, like, it's not going to turn Asdrubal Cabrera into Carlos Correa, but it's the sort of thing where, like, if there's a guy who's not like walking around the clubhouse with like the sad Charlie Brown music playing all the time, then like that counts for a lot. You know, like, so maybe he's good with that. I mean, either way, I presume that they hired him because he is forward thinking as a former relief pitcher, will not burn their bullpen to the ground, you know, before like Memorial Day. And and also will, you know, like, maybe have a good attitude that is reflected throughout the clubhouse. I'd love to think that's the case. I mean, if they return the same team, they will not do very well. But they could do better than they did with the same team if everybody's, you know, sort of producing. But they got, at the end of the year, I mean, like, it's hard to know with Conforto's injury, like, that's an injury that basically has never been observed in nature before.
Right.
You know, like, so what do you, like, a guy just, like, blows his shoulder out of his socket, swinging and missing at a pitch. Like, once you're dealing with stuff like that, it kind of, you're in the realm of omens and signs. It's, like, really difficult to believe that any rational approach to it is going to work one way or the other. You just have to wait until the curse is lifted.
As with Conforto, Matt Harvey could just be done at 29. I mean,
it happens. You know, it sucks, but it happens. Like, I think he could be managed better, you know, like, but he's also like a difficult guy, and, you know, there's no telling. Like, human bodies aren't really built to throw pitches.
They're not really built to do anything, now that I think about it. Maybe that's just a rationale for my own indolence. But
mine was built to be prone on a futon reading tweets and despairing. That's peak performance. You might not like it, but that's what I'm here for.
All of human evolution has led here to that.
I'm thinking of the Million Dollar Man thing where it's like, we can make him lazier, softer, more prone to outrage.
If you've seen 2001 A Space Odyssey, the hyper-evolved baby closes in on the Earth and then immediately shrinks down to normal size, descends, and hits the couch. Netflix goes on, and that's
tweets the words, Mungo fuck at Donald Trump Jr. I don't know. Seemed like the right thing to do at the time. I apologize.
And thus spoke Zarathustra.
I'm a star child, and I'm learning.
All science fiction predicting the future of humanity actually leads to that point. David, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
By the time we talk again, Thanksgiving will have passed, and we'll be zooming past the winter meetings and no doubt have a whole lot more stuff to discuss in terms of trades and free agency and
yeah,
that.
I'll have turned on Mickey Callaway by then, so that's something to look forward to.
You know, at his winter meetings press availability, he will have said, my plan is to bunt, and bunt some more. Yep. There are not too many outs you can give away. Bunting is underrated. We pitchers know this.
Yeah, I'm going to be upset about the fact that I think that they might think that they shouldn't sign Lorenzo Cain when I think they should. Which is good. I look forward to, of all the things to be upset about, that's when I at least know how to manage.
You know, I was tempted to say, well, and then I realized we'd be here another hour. So
yep. All right. We'll Good night, everybody. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
All right. No problem, dude. Thank you.
By the capering ponies of Lipizzan, we have made it to the end of another episode. You can follow David Roth at Twitter at David_J_Roth. Yes, those underscores are a secret gang sign, but we'll let that pass for now. And you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because Do Not Go Gently Into That Good Night Stephen Goldman made me feel kind of down. You can also write us, by which I mean me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com. We have sponsors now, sort of, but nonetheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 43. Our producer wishes me to issue the following disclaimer that, although my descriptions of him are based on real events, any similarities between real persons living or dead are purely coincidental. Our theme song, which you are hearing now and have been listening to throughout the episode, is called The Infinite Man, and it was co-authored by myself and Dr. Rick Mooring, whose latest composition is called Wine Rack. It's got a strange, ungainly rhythm that requires you to dance as if limping. Well, if these beavers don't succeed in chewing through my wooden leg and cause me to fall in a forest where nobody hears it, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the infinite inning.